From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, filling in for Terry Gross. Clifton Talbert grew up black in the segregated South in the 1950s, and while he says he would never want to see forced segregation again, it wasn't all bad. His first memoir, When We Were Colored, is about growing up before integration and is now being made into a movie. Coming up, we'll talk with Clifton Talbert. Also, we'll hear from Father Thomas Keating, who says if you want God to hear you, the secret may be in silence. Rock historian Ed Ward looks at why the international pop music scene missed America. And book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews the new comic novel Hunters and Gatherers, a story of goddess worship. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Clifton Talbert writes in his memoir, When We Were Colored, I would never want to return to forced segregation, but I also have a deeply felt sense that important values were conveyed to me in my colored childhood, values we are in danger of losing in our integrated world. He goes on to describe the loving and protective environment his extended family provided for him growing up in starkly segregated Glen Allen, Mississippi in the 1950s. He attended separate but equal schools, worked in the cotton fields, and was self-consciously deferential with whites. But his family taught him self-reliance, and after graduating from high school, he headed to St. Louis to get further education and find work. He wrote about those experiences in his second memoir, The Last Train North, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Both those books are out in paperback, and When We Were Colored is being made into a movie. Let's begin with Clifton Talbert reading from his first memoir. This is a passage about going with his grandfather to visit Greenville, a town near Glen Allen.
Wake up, boy. Wake up, we hear, Papa nudged. As I raised up to look around me, Papa was busy trying to find a parking space down by the levee. After Papa put his pennies in the meter, he'd grab my hand, and together we'd walk down the street to the bakery and the frozen custard stand. Because I was so fascinated by the crowd, Papa would jerk my hands to remind me of my place. I was so excited to get to the frozen custard stand that I hardly watched where I was walking. But he would pull me up just in time so that we could step aside and let white people pass. Papa would tip his hat and hold me closely by his side until the white people were clearly in front of us. Secure in the grip of Papa's calloused hands, I never stopped smiling. Because I could see the frozen custard stand. I had not a care in the world as I purchased my double cone of frozen custard ice cream, holding it in one hand while Papa's strong grip held my other. I was totally content. My world was complete and colored. With frozen custard dripping from my mouth, I walked with Papa a little further to the bakery. We could smell hot French bread all the way up the street. That long piece of French bread, please, sir, Papa asked the baker. As we both inhaled the yeasty smells of the bakery. Anything else, preacher? The baker asked, handing us the wrapped package. Reaching out to accept our money, the baker made sure his white hands did not touch Papa's strong colored ones. Once outside, this man I loved began to break the hot loaf into small pieces, and we ate as we walked back to the levee. Papa with his French bread and I with the last of my frozen custard walked down Washington Avenue hand in hand. Papa would complete the rest of his errands and visit a few friends. Then we'd begin the trip home to Glen Allen. I would settle in for a long nap as my Saturday ended, and Papa hummed, "That evening sun is setting fast."
And that's my guest, Clifton Talbert, reading from his memoir, When We Were Colored. I think that passage shows many things, but one of them is the subtleties of trying to navigate in that segregated world where your grandfather would pull you in to make sure that whites could pass you, where you noticed that white hands and black hands didn't touch when money changed hands. Is that how your family taught you to navigate this difficult world?
I don't think it was a teaching that one would give lessons and you would respond. But I've often said that Papa became an umbrella for a little boy who didn't have the power to stop the torrents of the rain of racism. And I lived under the shadow of that umbrella. And under that umbrella is, I think, is where the navigation took place.
But how did they protect you from a world, a society that decided that blacks and whites were different and that blacks were inferior to whites? How does a family protect a young, growing child from that message?
Racism lived in our community, but it didn't live in our house. And once we got on the front porch of Papa's house, that was his plot of land. That was his house. That's where he ruled and reigned. And it was from those front porches that they saw their future through the lengthening steps of their children and their grandchildren and great-grandchildren, of which I was one. And they told us who we were and from where we had come. They told us what they wanted us to be. And they made us believe that we could actually reach the stars.
Well, how much in a segregated world, and as you write about, this was a segregated world in the Deep South, how much real contact, or how much contact at all between whites and blacks?
There was contact. Social contact, as we understand it today, visiting, going to restaurants, doing things together, that type of contact did not exist. But I can remember when Mrs. Brown, the white family across the street, if she was cooking a cake and she ran out of flour or eggs, she was sent across our house to get some.
Would your mother, grandmother do that if they, if she ran out of eggs or flour? Would
no,
she go to the White
no,
House?
But we bought milk and eggs from them. And I can remember going into their home to get things. But I also knew that we, even though we would wave at each other, there was this invisible barrier that was there, a chasm that was called segregation that did not allow us to cross.
What does colored mean? And for a white person, it's awkward for me to say that word, but you use it and other people have used it, and it's certainly very much a part of your writing. What does that mean?
It's a time. It's the one word that conjures up the aunts and uncles, the grandparents, the Saturday fish fries, the sister worker society within the colored churches. It's the one word that conjures up the time that, in spite of legal segregation, there were this wonderful cadre of people that dreamed a better America. It was a term that we did not choose, but it was a term that became descriptive of who we were at a particular time in history.
Did your family believe in the American dream?
Without question.
Why?
You know, it's really funny. That was this passionate pursuit of the American dream. I mean, it was their home. America was their home. And for whatever they had suffered, they always believed that getting a piece of America was what life was really all about.
Even though the laws were against them.
Even though the laws were against them, you were pushed to college. You were pushed to achieve. And going north was not just to move out of a Jim Crow environment as much as it was to express those wonderful talents that they knew to be there. And they wanted to find a place for that expression.
Were you afraid, or are you afraid at all, that by writing about this part of your life and this piece of American history, that you are going to give segregation a good name?
No, you can't give segregation a good name. The times were bad, but the people were good. And that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to recall the good people who helped us to live through the bad times.
You write that your family seldom discussed politics. The only part, I guess, of politics that they discussed, which affected them very personally, was the poll tax. But one of your relatives says that's white folks' business.
Yeah, that the Freedom Riders, the civil rights movement, in the book that I'm writing now, they were the people who came into our world to unearth that desire to be involved. I've often said that Papa and the old preachers would sit in the front room, if you will, and there they would hold their version of meetings, a Congress that was in session, but no bills could be enacted. They weren't allowed to do that. They didn't understand the system, and the system was rigged in such a way that they weren't welcomed participants in it. And even the poster that you're referring to of Adlai Stevenson when he was running for president, the poster covered the wall of the Jake Stein store. And I remember sitting in the cab of my father's truck, and I said, "Who's that?"
Mm.
And it was a political candidate. And I remember distinctively my mother saying, "You don't need to know about that. That's white folks' business." We were so removed to a great extent from being involved in that world of politics, except for the NAACP, which was a voice for small towns and people like us.
Well, did the church replace the political party or the political life? Because you say the church was the sanctuary for our dreams and the closet for our secrets.
It didn't replace it, but what it did, it provided an outlet. The church became a microcosm of a world that we had not yet fully become part of. And within the church structure, you had your presidents, you had your Congress, you had your legislative members, you had your financial institutions. It was a very small reflection of the broader society, but it enabled a people who had pent-up desires and emotion to be bigger than just something, to allow the church to bring it out.
Any surprise that many of the political leaders came out of the black church?
It is no surprise to me at all, especially during the 50s and the early 60s, because that was one of the few places that allowed for freedom of expression, where one could actually vent their feelings, say what they wanted, and they were not under the auspices or under white control.
Do you remember feeling safe in church?
Yeah. Always felt safe there.
Describe for us the kind of school that you went to. The first school that you went to actually was a one-room schoolhouse, and all the children were there together.
Miss Maxie was the teacher. And I've often said, it's not that I'm so old that I went to a one-room school. It's just that Washington County took forever to change. And they built the big school. It took them years to complete it. But Miss Maxie taught in the school that had first been taught by Professor White. Everyone knew Professor White, as he was called. He taught my uncle and my mother. But once Miss Maxie came to town and all 8 grades were there in this one white building, and I'll always remember it, and she taught us all. And
how does one teach 1 through 8th grade?
Well, what you do, you become boss and you tell the other 7 to shut up. And they do, because those were the days when a teacher spoke, the students listened. And Ms. Maxie, but it was good in a way because it was an interchange of information. Not only were you learning first grade, but you were also hearing second grade and third grade and fourth grade. So it really wasn't a waste of time as much as it probably was an effort on her part. But we would sit there and we would learn at our desk, and she would write on the blackboards, and she would dismiss us to go, you know, to the bathroom. The nurse would come to give you booster shots. I mean, it seemed as if every disease cropped up around those years in school, and all the nurses were coming out to shoot you, as we call it. And we were literally afraid of that. But they wanted the best for us. And Miss Maxie would tell us that we belonged among the stars. And even though we lived in an inferior environment, we did not receive an inferior mindset.
So how equal were these separate but equal schools? Once this school building finally got constructed and you were able to move into that school, how equal would you say that education was from the white kids in your...
I would say the only thing equal about the system was the Flushing Johns. Since that both groups of us, both black and white, had grown up with outdoor toilets, we all had to learn how to use flush toilets in that part of the South. But once you got into the classrooms, the books, the materials, the support materials that were needed, we got the leftovers. I knew all the white boys' jokes because I got their books the next year. They would get the new books, and we would get the old books.
You get the hand-me-downs.
We get the hand-me-downs.
Were you aware of groups like the KKK and other?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, were you aware? Did you feel their presence?
You know, I didn't feel their presence as a child, but I was certainly aware of their existence. We knew who they were, the older people. I mean, they weren't like strangers who came into town. Many of them lived within our town. But it was a world that had existed, and it was parallel to the world we knew. And you spoke to each other occasionally. Even the man that I worked for, I later learned he was a chaplain for the Ku Klux Klan. I had no idea. But at the same time, our relationship was one that would have defied your thinking what it would have been. The South is very complicated in many of its social issues.
But would it be overstating it to say that during the day you would greet each other in the way that I guess you as a young black man was allowed to greet a white person, and at night they might be terrorizing your neighborhood?
Well, I wouldn't say terrorizing in the sense that something that happened on a continued basis. But let's say that something was going to happen that was going to certainly break the order by those people who felt we want things to stay as they are. Then this group of people, and it was not the whole town, but these group of people who somehow found it necessary to live by intimidating others and in causing fear, they seemed to come to the rescue of a system that was slowly falling around us.
Let me just talk a little bit with you about what it was like to imagine your life beyond where you grew up in Mississippi. And you had a family that was saying, Clifton, there is a life beyond this town. We want you to think beyond working in the cotton fields, which you did, but also where many people ended up spending the rest of their life. Did you feel disloyal at all to think that there was a life beyond Glenn Mills, Mississippi?
No, not at all. Mr. Fields, the man I call the big shot in Glen Allen, he lived in a shotgun house that wasn't even his. It belonged to Mrs. Spencer. But sometimes he would take me on his back porch, and he would emotionally place me on his shoulders. And I remember distinctively him saying, why don't you become an architect? Be a doctor. This man had less than a third grade education, but he showed me a world that I couldn't see with my eyes. And somehow, I think in his own way, he gave his dreams to me and said, take them, boy, and see what you can do with them.
Clifton Talbert lives in Oklahoma and is working on his third memoir. A movie version of his first memoir, When We Were Colored, is due out this fall. It's directed by Tim Reed and stars Felicia Rashad and Al Freeman Jr. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Rock historian Ed Ward is now living in Europe, where he says the popular music is pop. The basic values of pop are there in American music, but Ed says it's sometimes harder to find.
The Chills' Heavenly Pop hit is only 5 years old, but it represents a type of music enjoyed the world over, except in America. Mostly, it's called pop, and it has hundreds of subdivisions. Some, like the German Schlager, ghastly. Others, like the Australian-New Zealand pop scene, epitomized by the Chills and the Verlaines, well, heavenly. It started with the Beatles and quickly spread through the English-speaking world. Fresh scrub voices, jangly guitars backing 3-minute songs with hooks placed in them so you can't forget them, try as you might. The psychedelic era produced pop with significance, though, and worse, it produced music that thought it was art. By the end of the 70s, we were exhausted by art and longed for something new. And we got it.
Every time I see you, I wish I could believe.
The Shoes, to pick a band at random, were four guys from Zion, Illinois, who had internalized pop and produced their own take on it, while remaining true to the basics of melody, harmony, and hooks. In Britain, pop had never died, and riding the coattails of punk, hundreds of pop bands were making their own records and writing quirkier songs. Some, like Nick Lowe and Elvis Costello, had come from the pub rock era earlier in the decade, while others just came out of nowhere. And many of them, like Eddie and the Hot Rods, went right back there, too. Pop is nothing if not ultimately disposable, if its makers can't keep coming up with the goods. The pop underground had been in place throughout the 70s, both in America, where bands revered the all-but-unknown Big Star, a Memphis band featuring box-top singer Alex Chilton, which created a pop legend far larger than the number of records they sold, and in Britain, where pub rock bands like Brinsley Schwartz and Ducks Deluxe kept the fire burning. And undergrounds tend to have their day in the sun eventually, as grunge conveniently proved recently. Visiting Britain in 1980, I thought I'd died and gone to pop heaven. When I got back to the States, I had to wonder what went wrong. The problem, essentially, was radio in 1980, and radio was having none of this, even though the music was custom made for it. Not to mention bands that confused the issue. Buzzcocks, everybody knew, were a punk band. Thus, they were ineligible for airplay, no matter that their actual records got poppier and poppier. And as for American bands, try as they might to disguise it by calling it New Wave, their pop, too, was just as unwelcome. Around Hoboken, New Jersey alone, a score of great bands came and went. The DBs, the Bongos, the Feelies, the list goes on. Occasional pop bands broke through. The big exception was Blondie, who did very well. Yet, considering the amount of great music being made during 1977 to 82, say, what's really amazing is how little of it got heard, compared to the amount of disco, for instance, during its heyday. Pop lives today. Just ask Matthew Sweet, who did very well with Girlfriend, a total pop masterpiece. Those of us who've loved pop since it began know that Green Day is just another pop band in punk clothes, and it was hooks that got Nirvana onto the radio. But I'm suggesting that if you love pop's place in the rock universe, you might find it worthwhile to revisit the days when it was being reinvented. Good pop, after all, is timeless.
Ed Ward is a writer living in Berlin. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, The Power of Silence. Father Thomas Keating teaches contemplative prayer, a method that, like meditation, is void of words and thoughts. Also, book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Hunters and Gatherers, a comic novel about a band of Manhattan goddess worshippers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. In 1981, my guest, Father Thomas Keating, retired from St. Joseph's Abbey in Spencer, Massachusetts, where he was the abbot. He moved to an abbey in Snowmass, Colorado, looking forward to a quiet life during his later years. But just as he retired, he began getting calls from all over the country to conduct workshops in a technique of centering prayer he developed after studying with a Zen Buddhist master. Father Thomas's idea was to bring the contemplative tradition of the monastery to people who lead active lives in the world. There was such a demand for Father Thomas to teach centering prayer that a whole movement sprang up called Contemplative Outreach. Father Thomas is now booked a year in advance. He conducts workshops, produces videotapes, and has written many books. We're happy to have him joining us today on the phone from his monastery in Colorado because in 2 weeks he'll go into a period of solitude and silence for 5 months. But before he stops talking, I asked him to define contemplative prayer for us.
Maybe I could define contemplative prayer as the development of one's relationship with Christ to the point of communing beyond words, thoughts, and feelings.
So are you talking then about literally sitting in a quiet room, shutting out all the sounds of the outside world, in a sense, meditating? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes. In the Christian tradition, this is called discursive meditation, where one reflects on the good things of Scripture and makes them one's own. It's the opposite of speed reading, where one sort of absorbs the text and relates it to one's own daily life, and thus one gradually assimilates the teaching of Jesus and the other scriptures, and begins to enter what you might call a getting acquainted period, like you would in any human relationship. In other words, you have frequent interviews, or you have a heavy date with someone you want to get acquainted with. And as you keep this up, your acquaintanceship moves into might be called friendliness. You know, at first you feel, you know, you have to have your hair a certain way and you have to have a bow tie on and you have to make a good impression on the other person. But after you get better acquainted and have searched one's history and what you like and don't like, then you can put your foot up on the table and smoke a cigar and not be afraid that it would spoil the relationship. And so it's the frequency or the regularity of having an interview, so to speak, with God, that is the basis of getting acquainted. And as this friendliness develops, it invites us into a commitment that there's a friendship.
When talking about contemplative prayer, I'm curious whether movement has borrowed from Eastern religions, from transcendental meditation, and the kinds of religious quests that seem to focus very much on meditation, on mantras, on words that get you to a physiological, psychological, and maybe, if you're lucky, a kind of a spiritual state.
Well, these practices are certainly have great value, but they're not the source of Christian contemplation, which is rooted in the personal love of Christ and this growing relationship. Prayer might be defined as relationship, and a relationship, if it's alive, tends to grow and to deepen and to become more and more spontaneous and more enveloping of one's whole life and motivation. So centering prayer is not a technique in the sense of reaching a certain state consciousness, however valuable that might be, but it's rather of reaching a relationship of ever deepening love with the one whom we regard as the source of our being.
You've said that silence, and this is a quote, silence is the language that God speaks. And I would assume that someone who is just starting out and trying to I guess, read or understand that silence, that it must be very difficult to understand what you're looking for, because we're such a verbal culture. We put so much value in language and in words, and to put so much value in the absence of those things must be very difficult for someone to get used to.
Well, it is. It is a little difficult, although some people are quite prepared for it without realizing it and enter it quite easily and then are inspired by the Spirit to put in the foundational aspects of the relationship. In other words, what contemplative prayer does is frees us from an over-identification with the cultural conditioning of early childhood, because it moves us into an interior freedom where we can question some of the things that we absorbed unquestioningly at that very impressionable age. Most of us are more or less over-identified with our ordinary psychological awareness, that is, with events and people and our reactions to them, so that our mental life is dominated by what happens to us as if we were in a movie. And I over-identified with all the characters and forgot that we were in the theater. Well, through contemplative practice, which deliberately leaves that ordinary level of psychological awareness to cultivate the spiritual level of our being, but we begin to gain a certain interior freedom, so that it's like being at a lousy movie where you know you can get up and leave at any time. So you begin to have the freedom to choose what you want to do, rather than to be pushed around emotionally by events or people or our emotional reactions to them.
Well, let me ask you another very secular question, though. What guarantee from contemplative prayer that when you enter this place that you will find God? How do you know that you just won't find yourself and all the stuff, you know, all that, whether it's psychological stuff or cultural stuff, or just all that, you won't just find yourself there instead of finding God?
Oh, this is an excellent question. And I think this might actually happen if you didn't enter it with the understanding and intention of faith. One needs to have an attitude of trust towards God, that if one is really seeking Him, as some of the early fathers of the Church said, He is seeking us even more. So that I venture to say, however, that even if one takes a few moments for quiet and enters into oneself, since God is at the center of ourselves, whether aware of it or not, that one might very easily find God even without intending to.
Father Thomas Keating joins us from an abbey in Snowmass, Colorado, to talk about the contemplative outreach movement. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Trappist monk Thomas Keating. I'd like to ask you some personal questions. You became a monk at the age of 20. I believe you were at Yale University at the time. What led you to seek the monastic life?
Well, it was at Yale when I was 18 to 20 that I came very interested, through studying some of the modern philosophies, in reviewing the basics of the Catholic faith in which I was raised. And so in reading Tolstoy and other writers, I had doubts, and I entered into a period of great struggle and introspection. And at a certain point, I discovered in the library a set of books that were commentaries on the four Gospels of Jesus, line by line, collected by St. Thomas Aquinas. And it was reading in that book that I grasped that the Christian religion is basically a contemplative religion, and that the contemplative dimension of the gospel is the essential part of the teaching. And that seed has continued to grow, you might say, all my life. I left Yale at the time the war began because I had other commitments I'd promised to do.
And this was World War II.
World War II, and I actually graduated from Fordham University in 1943, and a week later I entered the monastery that I had discovered. And in those days, it was generally taught that the more difficult or ascetical life you chose, the more likely you were to become a contemplative. And since that's what I wanted, that's what I looked around for, and I think I succeeded. But I would no longer believe in that principle anymore, because my studies and my own experience have taught me that God is present to everybody and is calling everyone who is seeking him, or certainly the baptized persons, into the fullness of the divine life of love that circulates in the Trinity. And so I entered the monastery, and that strictness of life was very helpful in the beginning. We too have gone through many changes since the Second Vatican Council, and perhaps the life now is a little more balanced than it was at that time.
Well, I'm curious even what that early life was like in a monastery. Was it total silence?
Well, for beginners, it was pretty close to a total silence. You could speak to two people, a novice master and the abbot. But you couldn't speak to each other, and so it wasn't possible to make friends. You don't usually make friends with your superiors. Because they could always ask you to leave. So it was certainly a very silent life. And,
was it a lonely life?
Well, it was very exciting, actually, because we were learning about and studying the Gospels through the very rich Christian tradition of mysticism and so on. So there was I was cultivating the friendship of Christ much as I could, and that friendship was that, for those first few years, are all absorbing, you might say. Later, we have modified the rule of silence considerably so that friendship among the monks is now possible.
Did you?
In those days, we got up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and we had a lot of vocal prayers all day long, and the work was hard, and we fasted a good deal. So that the ascetical life or a penitential life was emphasized much more than the contemplative life.
Let me ask you about the effect of Vatican II on your work. Were you an abbot then in Spencer, Massachusetts during Vatican II?
Yes, I was.
How did that change your work and even life within that monastery?
Well, because we were asked to review our rules in the light of the gospel and the founders, and also of modern conditions, it brought about a very dramatic self-examination that was really quite traumatic for some in the monasteries, because it sort of questioned the value of a life which many of us had put our lives on the line to live. And so there was a lot of polarization in cloistered communities during those days, and this gradually subsided in some degree, at least. But it brought about more changes in our particular monastery's way of life and the order to which we belong in 5 years and in probably the previous 1,000 years. So it was the speed of the changes and the polarization of those who wanted to go slow and those who wanted to go fast, or not at all, that created a lot of tension in cloistered life then, which was very poignant because everybody was so sincere and so convinced of what they thought was the right way to proceed that it was tough going.
I'm kind of stuck on this idea of being quiet, I guess, because it's so hard to even imagine what that is like. Did you find early on that silence was a burden, or that you had a thought and you just said, oh, I must tell somebody about this, but of course not being able to?
Well, of course, there are always those thoughts, but if you're sold out, as I was, on the process of deepening one's contemplative life, one has the value system to overcome all the difficulties and the motivation to keep going in spite of those kinds of contrary motivations. So I don't recommend that degree of quietness, but I recommend very much a certain degree of it that is appropriate to one's, you know, duties in life. All of us, I think, need periods of silence because there's a part of us, the spiritual part, that thrives on a certain peace of mind, and quiet, and external quiet tends to help to foster that. And that's why people go to retreat houses in such numbers. Our idea in contemplative outreach was to provide a very simple structure and instruction for lay folks so that they get the benefits of the monastic life without entering it. The centering prayer is really the kind of the quintessence of monastic prayer, which is to be in the presence of God all the time, whatever we're doing.
Well, I know you're a busy person, and Father Thomas, I thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Father Thomas Keating is a leader in the contemplative outreach movement. In 2 weeks, he'll go into a 5-month period of solitude and silence. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Noah, what stories do you have for us?
Hi, Marty. Whitewater investigations are continuing in the House and the Senate. In the Senate, charges today that the Clinton administration was standing in the way of questions about Whitewater. NPR's Maria Inahosa reports on young people in Cuba deciding to take their own lives by injecting HIV that causes AIDS. I'll talk with NPR's Mike Schuster. He's in a small, previously Serb town in the Krajina. He describes the shelling there and the exodus of the refugees and the fact that some Croatians are already moving into the area. And I'll talk with the director of an insurance company in London offering a retirement annuity that pays more money to people who smoke.
Noah, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Francine Prose's new comic novel, Hunters and Gatherers, takes on goddess worshippers and other New Age feminists. Maureen Cargan has a review.
I put Hunters and Gatherers in the same category with Christopher Buckley's essays and reruns of The Benny Hill Show, things that have made me laugh despite their dubious sexual politics. Actually, Francine Prose's latest novel isn't quite so bad. It'll only seriously offend those diehard difference feminists who really do believe that women who run with wolves on Venus are inherently superior to men who play with fire on Mars. Hunters and Gatherers is a glossy equivalent of those many satires of Robert Bly and his Iron John tom-tom beaters. Here, the target is a wealthy Manhattan community of New Age goddess worshippers who behave less like the amiable, non-competitive March sisters in Little Women and more like the women of Cell Block B. Our guide into the world of these weird sisters is a lonely young woman named Martha, who's spending Labor Day weekend on Fire Island recovering from a broken romance. While glumly walking along the beach, she stumbles upon a druid holy night ceremony the goddess worshippers are conducting. Their high priestess, a woman called Isis Moonwagon, has waded into the surf and, despite her divine aura, finds herself drowning in the undertow. Martha rescues Isis and consequently becomes an honored member of the coven. Soon thereafter, she's off with them on a pilgrimage to an Arizona Indian reservation, where they hope to learn primitive, womanly rituals involving skulls and menstruation huts, and where they'll sit around the campfire at night discussing cronehood empowerment and vegetable rights. Instead, as Isis admits, the trip degenerates into a feminist version of Lord of the Flies. The one unbreakable rule about a satire like Hunters and Gatherers is that it must never flag. And with the exception of the very end of her novel, prose does manage to keep the jokes and witticisms rolling. When Martha tells the story of her sad love life to her newfound soul sisters, she recalls that one of the things her old boyfriend said he liked about her was that she always got what he was saying. Men, cackles one of the goddess worshippers, their definition of female intelligence is when we understand them. When Martha hesitates about joining the matriarchal pilgrims on their Arizona adventure, she thinks to herself, imagine walking into a desert truck stop with a dozen goddess women, half of them dressed like Mama Cass, and all with bizarre dietary restrictions. And after the women arrive at the Four Feathers Institute, they meet a Native American con artist named Rita, dressed in a beaded headband, feather bonnet, layers of butter-colored chamois fringe, and squash blossom jewelry. My God, Martha exclaims, she looks like a Ralph Lauren armchair. In a much less ambitious way, Prose's novel reminds me of David Lodge's brilliant series of fictional send-ups of Academe. Both Prose and Lodge lambaste earnest, closed societies that think they've found the truth. But Hunters and Gatherers is a novel that chiefly celebrates silliness for its own sake. There's no deep messages here. Prose, like her characters, searches for the goddess within. But instead of Venus or Athena or Kali, she summons up the comic consciousnesses of Gracie Allen, Lucille Ball, and Roseanne.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Hunters and Gatherers, a new novel by Francine Prose. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landrell. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia and from Rhino Records, presenting the new album Till the Night Is Gone, a collection of Doc Pomus classics by Sean Colvin, Bob Dylan, and others. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The U.S. ambassador to Croatia says he has reports of Croatian troops firing at refugees today, allegedly because Serb tanks were in the area and targeting Croatian soldiers. The latest reported clashes come despite UN efforts to arrange a ceasefire between Croatian government forces and rebel Serbs to keep tens of thousands of Serb refugees out of the line of fire. From Zadar, Croatia, NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
From what I understand, there is an agreement for the UN to, or at least international aid agencies, to start an airlift into Bosnian Serb territory, to Banja Luka, in order to begin to help the refugees, because a huge number of them are still in Bosnia. And then there is also a desire to help the Serbian government cope with the problem, because thousands of them have now traveled across Bosnia through Bosnian-held territory into Serbia. Serbia has begun to set up camps on its border with Bosnia, but it's unprepared for this and is obviously going to need international help.
NPR's Mike Schuster in Croatia, where army officials say several thousand Serb fighters have surrendered in the region south of Zagreb. 25 people, many of them Russian immigrants, have been charged with using a network of phony companies to bilk the government out of $140 million in fuel taxes. Federal prosecutors in New Jersey say the suspects would buy non-taxable home heating oil and then sell it as taxable diesel fuel and pocket the state and federal tax charges. A tough screening program is going into effect in New York City. It's intended to trim welfare rolls there by 100,000 people before the end of the year. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC reports from New York.
According to one lawyer who represents the poor, it's the most aggressive effort to deny public assistance in New York in 20 years. But a senior advisor to Republican Mayor Rudolph Giuliani insists that no worthy applicants are being denied. Richard Schwartz tells the New York Times the in-depth screening process is needed to protect the integrity of the welfare system. Interviews in welfare offices and in the field are designed to confirm applicants' addresses and other sources of income. The city's home relief payroll for able-bodied adults has been cut by 40,000 people since January, with another 65,000 to be dropped by year's end. Before adoption of the new budget last month, the Giuliani administration doubled its estimate of welfare fraud savings from $100 to $200 million. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
The productivity of American workers rose at an annual rate of 3% in the second quarter of the year, but the Labor Department says the increased efficiency of workers was not totally reflected in their compensation. Hourly wages, adjusted for inflation, rose just 0.2% in the second quarter. On Wall Street, just before the close, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down nearly 4 points at 4689.45 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Thousands of Jewish demonstrators in Israel blocked traffic and skirmished with police today to protest the peace talks between Israel and the PLO. The protesters were organized by the group This Is Our Land, which has vowed to prevent the planned Israeli troop withdrawal from areas of the West Bank. The PLO and Israel today finally agreed to a timetable for that withdrawal, which will take until at least February of 1997. At the House Whitewater hearings, three savings and loan regulators say top administration officials tried to block the government probe of a failed Arkansas savings and loan whose director was a business partner of President Clinton. The White House says the president is ready to take action to protect America's young people from the ill effects of tobacco use. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
President Clinton has been wrestling with the decision about how to stop cigarette smoking among teenagers for weeks. One option is to allow the FDA to regulate tobacco as a drug and put restrictions on vending machines, cigarette advertising, and even cigarette sales. Another is to work out a voluntary agreement with the tobacco industry. In an interview with NPR yesterday, the president indicated how he was leaning.
I think we need a tough and mandatory type program. But I don't want to see us in a position where we act like we're going to do something, but we wind up in years and years and years of costly litigation.
The president is expected to discuss his decision when he visits Charlotte, North Carolina tomorrow in the heart of tobacco country. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
In London, a financial services firm has announced that it will begin offering soon a special pension annuity. It's designed exclusively for smokers, and it will pay out about 8% more a year than comparable pension annuities for non-smokers. Stalwart Assurance Limited says it can afford to pay smokers more because they'll die sooner. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The head of the Drug Enforcement Administration says Mexican drug traffickers could soon replace Colombia's Cali cartel as the main suppliers of illegal drugs to the U.S. Thomas Constantine told a Senate panel that the price of speed has already fallen by over 50% in California because of the abundant supply of the drug from south of the border. A new government report says more than one-sixth of the nation's senior citizens are being prescribed medications that are unsafe for their age group or are duplicates of other prescriptions. A study by the General Accounting Office found that older people on inappropriate medicine can suffer adverse reactions ranging from drowsiness to death. The Defense Department is denying that a U.S. Army officer detained by Russian intelligence officials in Siberia was engaged in spying. The Russians claim Captain Jason Lynch was collecting information near a nuclear weapons installation. Paul Brandis reports from Moscow.
Captain Lynch was arrested on August 3rd. A spokesman for the Russian Federal Security Service, or FSB, says he was held for questioning for a few hours, then released. Lynch was arrested near Krasnoyarsk 26 in central Siberia. It's one of Russia's most sensitive nuclear weapons research and production facilities. Captain Lynch teaches geography and environmental engineering at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. The Russian Defense Ministry says he was gathering data on radioactive contamination of a Siberian river when he was arrested. It's unknown whether Captain Lynch is still here in Russia. The U.S. Embassy says it's trying to track him down. A spokesman said the embassy wants to hear Lynch's side of the story. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Brandis in Moscow.
Organizers of the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City in 2002 say the surprisingly high bid from NBC for broadcast rights puts them ahead of schedule and millions ahead in revenue. NPR's Howard Berkus has the story.
Olympic boosters here haven't even formally named their organizing committee. They just won their Winter Olympic bid in June. The games are 7 years away, and they didn't expect broadcast rights discussions for another 2 years. So they were pleasantly shocked by NBC's take-it-or-leave-it offer, which gives them a record $550 million and gives a record $700 million to the organizers of the Summer Olympics in Sydney, Australia in the year 2000. Salt Lake Olympic organizers say they're getting $89 million more than expected, bolstering their claim that they will not need a taxpayer bailout. They expect the early deal to bring higher fees from corporate sponsors, the biggest chunk of the budget for the 2002 Winter Games. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
On Wall Street today, stock prices closed mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average remained unchanged to close at 4693.32. Declining issues led advances 11-9 in active trading. This is NPR News. Croatia's army says some 4,000 Serb fighters have surrendered in the region south of Zagreb. That word comes hours after the UN said it was trying to arrange a ceasefire to protect the tens of thousands of Serb refugees trying to get out of Croatia. One of the complaints of sexual misconduct against Oregon Senator Bob Packwood reportedly involves a minor. Today's Portland Oregonian says the then 17-year-old girl was working as an intern in Packwood's office in 1983 when he allegedly grabbed and kissed her. The U.S. has granted $2.1 million to a U.N. agency to fight child labor in Asia. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The money will go to projects of the United Nations International Labor Organization. It will be used to combat child prostitution in Thailand and the exploitation of working children in Bangladesh. The funds are part of a program authorized by Congress to fight the use of child labor in food products exported to the United States. Deputy Undersecretary of Labor Jack Otero says not only is it tragic that in many parts of the globe children must forfeit their education in order to work, but many of them work in brutal slave-like conditions. The Labor Department says it's also working on a labor organization proposal to discourage the practice of adults binding children to work in India and a program to stop child labor in Brazil's shoe industry. In Bangladesh, the effort will be to get children out of the workplace and into schools. The U.S. Embassy there will join with local and international groups to set up an inspection system to keep children out of clothing factories. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
New York has a strange summer visitor. A 1,200-pound manatee has been spotted in the city's East River. It's a long way from his Florida home, but this creature is known to have a penchant for travel. His name is Chessie after he spent last summer in the Chesapeake Bay. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been monitoring his journeys with a radio tracking device. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.